Hello, and welcome to the Write Club podcast, where we take you behind the pages and into the fascinating world of writing. I'm Beth, and this is Mary, and we're part of the team at Writer Magazine and Writers Online. Hi, Mary, how are you today?
I'm really well, thank you. Our guest this week is Hazel Barkworth. Hazel grew up in Stirlingshire and North Yorkshire before studying English at Oxford. She then moved to London, where she worked as a cultural consultant. Hazel is a graduate of both the Oxford University MST in Creative Writing and the Curtis Brown Creative Novel Writing course. Her debut novel, Heatstroke, was published by Headline in 2020, and her second novel, The Drownings, is out now. Hazel lives in York with her partner. Hazel, welcome. Where are you joining us from today?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I am currently sitting at my dining room table slash desk in my living room, surrounded by books.
It looks lovely.
Yeah, I wish our listeners could see what we could see right now. It looks absolutely stunning. And is that your writing space?
It's not, no, I sort of wish it was. I wish I was sort of elegant writer who would sit down at a desk and write in a calm, considered way. This is where I work. In my day job, I still do consultancy as a freelancer. And if I'm doing that kind of work, I absolutely sit on the proper ergonomic chair with the proper laptop set up and the ergonomic mouse all ready. In reality, when I'm writing, it never feels particularly creative to sit in that more rigid space. So, to be completely honest, I write on my bed with throws and cushions and soft things, and I make a sort of nest essentially with my laptop, prop a different laptop as well. I have to use different ones for both jobs. I think there's a real thing in my brain of sort of separating the idea of work from the idea of writing and keeping writing as this sort of treat, really, this sort of delicious hobby that I still get to go back to and still feel excited about. And ideally for me, a writing day is one that I still really look forward to, and it still feels like a privilege every time I get to do it. So I think I make a real point of dividing out the different sorts of work. Also, I think the work I do sort of uses some of the same muscles in my brain as writing, and there's a risk of getting a bit of overlap. So I like to keep them completely separate and keep that soft, joyful space as a place that I think it can almost become a bit liminal. And I definitely sometimes, because I'm on my bed, will fall asleep for brief slash quite long naps, but I'm sure that's a creative process. I'm sure there's some science behind that as being absolutely brilliant. And I do find if I've had a bit of a nap, I wake up either feeling more creative or feeling more stressed that I haven't been creative. But either way, I definitely write more words after it.
Do you have a dream about the book?
I dream really vividly, which I think might be not because I have a very active imagination, but because I take a lot of antihistamines for hay fever, which apparently is not too vivid dreams, but I do dream quite vividly. Like I will wake up sometimes quite furious at somebody because of something they've done, or thinking about an old friend. I have to text them and be like, "Haven't seen you in 8 years, but we met last night in the body shop in a strange universe." And so sometimes parts of my dreams feed into what I'm writing, although. And because I sometimes write about settings I have experienced, I will go back to those worlds. I have a beautiful dream universe that unfortunately you can only remember little fragments of. But if I could write that, it'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I always think that about my own dreams is that they would make a brilliant book or movie or series or something, but they probably wouldn't make much sense.
Isn't it? It would be quite avant-garde.
Yeah. And have you always wanted to be a writer? And can you remember your first story?
I've always wanted to be a published writer. I think that came a lot later for me. But I think, like most writers, my first love is reading. So from a very young age, was reading avidly, albeit I don't think I ever read any of the classics that bookish children are meant. I've never read The Secret Garden. I read a lot of The Babysitter's Club and Sweet Valley Twins, which is my cultural heritage. It still has its own value. And I did write from a young age. I still have sort of manuscript. My older sister typed it up for me. And I from what I can, I still have that, it's about 10 chapters long. So a relatively big investment of time. And from what I can gauge, I was about seven. I think it was the summer I was seven and wrote the Gus and Gusella Chronicles, which you think now, I think the amount of time that took out of a summer holiday that to sit and scribble this and presumably bully my sister into typing it all up for me on her word processor in the would have been the late 80s. I clearly thought it was aspirational. I clearly thought that was a thing worth giving my time and energy to. And I had the impetus and eagerness to build this story and build these characters and create their world. So while I'm not sure that book in and of itself is brilliant, there's definitely the seeds of storytelling and the seeds of thinking that's an amazing thing to spend time doing.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Can you tell us a little bit about your current novel, The Drownings?
Yes, The Drownings tells the story of Serena, who is a championship swimmer, like nearly Olympic level brilliant swimmer, who suffers a catastrophic career-ending accident. She then finds herself on this slightly creepy, very beautiful, atmospheric northern university campus where she's going to study. And at the same time, her cousin, Zara, who is a body positivity influencer, is also going there to study just by coincidence. Both of them become very enthralled by a graduate student, Jane, who is obsessed with what happened on that land hundreds of years ago. And what happened there was women were murdered in the name of the witch trials. And Jane is obsessed with this from a historical perspective, but they begin to see the connections between what happened then and how women and people are treated on that campus today. And it sparks fury in them, and it also sparks the desire to protest and to change things, but things get out of hand.
It's such an atmospheric book. Me and Beth had a long discussion about it the other day. We're both found so much to talk about. In our July issue, you were our first 5 pages author, and you described Serena, the main character, as being ill at ease and uncomfortable in her surroundings, and also physically as she's crashing around on crutches at the start of the novel. Why was it important for you to introduce Serena in this way at the start of the book?
First of all, that was such a fun article to write. It was a really interesting way to go back. I wanted Serena, and the beginning of the book did change several times until I landed on this idea of her walking badly. She's on crutches, sort of clambering through the campus. Serena was named Serena because siren, mermaid, like her space is the sea. And I like the idea that on dry land, she isn't herself. She's gone from being so dazzlingly brilliant at something, and suddenly it's all been stripped away, and she's left in a sort of less than normal position. Like, not only is she struggling to walk, and walking is not her natural state, she's struggling to know emotionally how to fit in. She's been underwater for a decade. She hasn't done all the things that every other teenager and adolescent and child actually has done. And she sort of arrives a bit blank and completely unaware of what's around her, unaware of the social norms and what everyone else is doing. And I love this idea of the first time you see her, she's struggling. And the first time you see her, she's unable to do quite an ordinary thing. And it just felt like a really interesting way to start her journey and see how she becomes more and more, in some ways, at ease, and in some ways, far less at ease.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like she had to start again physically, didn't she? But also mentally, and actually be able to kind of start again from a teenager point of view, I guess, because she missed all of that whilst she was swimming. And then it almost her going to study at university, that was her like high school almost, or secondary school.
Almost like she has to go through those stages in the space of a couple of weeks or months rather than the years that everybody else had the chance to do. She sort of catapulted into having to speed up on the stuff she's missed out on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the descriptions of the competitive swimming and the toll that it takes on the girls' bodies, and the unhealthy emphasis on power and winning at all costs. And then the clever way the book compares this with the world of influencers. In this case, Serena's cousin Zara, who's a body positive influencer, and the ensuing competition between the two of them. What was it about these two worlds that you were drawn to explore?
A really interesting question, thank you. With the swimming, I was told a story by a friend about their cousin who was a competitive swimmer who had an accident and could no longer swim. I've never swum even vaguely competitively in my life. It's not something I have any experience of, but this story really stuck with me. This idea of someone being world class, like really phenomenal at something, and then having in a heartbeat that power stripped away, and suddenly leaving them almost in a sort of negative position rather than the enormous positive they once were. So I had to do a huge amount of research into swimming, which was fascinating, actually, really, like learning about the technicality of how a stroke works, learning about the amount of protein you have to eat and how you train and the timings, and It was a really fascinating look at the idea. I think it's fascinating. We watch the Olympics, it's so inspiring in some ways. But half, well, the majority of the people who get to there don't win. They don't win the thing they went there for. Well, I was fascinated by the story of these people who don't even get there, who are at county level or national level, and are, I mean, compared to the rest of us, absolutely astonishing, but they're not quite making the cut to become world famous or to sort of make history. And how does it feel to be brilliant, but not the absolute best? And also, what happens when you lose that thing that sets you apart? So it felt really fascinating to me to explore swimming. Also, the water imagery was so exciting to look at. There was so much fun stuff to dive into. And in terms of the two different bodies, I like the idea that both Serena and Zara are engaged in a sort of Faustian pact, like they've both sacrificed or given their bodies in different ways for some sense of power or success or prowess or what might have felt like power. And with Zara, she shows her body online to empower herself, to empower others, and slowly begins to realize she's actually losing sovereignty over that body she exists within. And whether it's Serena making her body move faster than anybody else's and treating it like a machine in many ways that can incrementally get faster and better and stronger, or Zara using her body as the site of a conversation, they both dislocate from those bodies in quite similar ways. And those bodies that look physically very different are alien in a similar way to the people that live within them.
Yeah, I loved them two's relationship and the competitiveness between the two of them. And women's power is a strong theme throughout the entire book. And I really love the line about Serena's coach, where she said, "This man's voice should never have been in her head, twisting her thoughts. It was cruel and unnatural, and she had her own power now." Heard her own words, and I wondered if you had struggled to hear your own words and believe in your own power.
Really interesting question. I certainly think there are times I felt like my words haven't been heard as much. I think anyone who has joined in with hundreds or thousands of others to protest for or against things they believe are right or wrong in the world and feeling like that's not being listened to can make you feel quite futile. It can be incredibly frustrating. So there's definitely been times I feel, and I hope I managed to channel some of that into the protest side of the novel where they want to make the world a better place, but don't know the tools. And I don't think any of us know the methods through which to do that in a way that really has our voices heard. And I certainly think my journey with writing and finding my voice as a writer took a long time, actually. I think I was in my early 30s when I suddenly thought, I need to take this really seriously. I need to believe in this in a way that I, to that point, I was scribbling a lot. I was writing sort of things that were reminiscent of novels, but didn't really become them. And in the end, I went back to university to do my master's, which I did my master's at Oxford. And the course there is all about finding your voice and believing in that voice, finding out what makes you unique as a writer. So you have to try things in completely different mediums. So I was having to find out what my voice as a poet was, which I'd never even considered because I'm a prose writer. And then going back to that after trying those different methods, those different modes, and seeing what it left you with and seeing what you want to write about, what sort of, and why you have the right to do that, and what you have to say that might be a bit different to other people, and the sort of writer you want to be going forward. And that helped me enormously, I think, to work out what I want my voice to say and the sort of power that can come along with that.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Can you take us inside your creative process? Do you plot everything meticulously, or do you let the story unfold as you're writing?
Somewhere a bit in between. Every novel I've written so far, I've had a sort of 10-page swiftly written synopsis, like very long, overarching. I know where these characters, I know who the characters are, I know the major events they will go through, and I know where they're heading at the end. I've always known the end of the stories before I've begun. Almost the final page has been in my head before starting. But within each scene of that, I have no idea how it's going to go. I know we have a scene where they are going to go into the forest and discover something. I don't quite know how that's going to look or feel or what the characters will do. They can guide a little bit in that space. So it still feels like there's a lot of discovery on the way to get people from A to B to C. And I think the way I write is still a hangover of writing alongside a full-time job, which is fitting it into evenings, weekends, lunch hours, train journeys, etc. Those little snatched bits of time where you don't have a lot of expanse and maybe a lot of energy, but you still need to be keeping your head in the story. So I carry notebooks, and I carry a really, I'm incredibly specific. It has to be one of those moleskin jotters, the Cahier ones. Get three in a pack, and I live and die by them, and no lines on the page because I scribble a lot. So I'll be sort of gathering this like bricolage of ideas, and it can be a little bit of dialogue or a nice description or just the idea for a scene. Like I say, each scene to me is still an uncharted territory when I reach it, and suddenly I'll go, that's the angle in. Because I always think with a scene, I know I need to get two characters to have an argument, right? What are they going to be doing while that's happening? Can I make that more interesting? I remember when Game of Thrones came out, they used to do those scenes of exposition, and it would be Littlefinger speaking while sort of some prostitutes were doing their work behind him. And it's just so much more interesting to hear about war strategy when you're watching whatever that was. And I love the idea of like finding a way to make each scene more delicious. There's a scene in The Drownings where someone is telling a story about their past, and I'd written it, and I was like, this is a little bit boring. So I put it in a fairground because it was so much more fun to write that story with a mechanized kraken hurling towards them in every part of the conversation. So sometimes I'll think, oh, that could be an interesting way, and I'll scribble down mechanized kraken, etc. And then I have these bits of notebooks. Also, if I'm sitting at my desk, I'd love to be one of those writers who could just write 1,000 words out calmly and coolly, but I write in little bits and pieces and moments, and then my job is to shape that into paragraphs and sentences that hopefully make enough sense and weave it all together to become the whole. And I think it's about discovering as well that so much of writing is not about being at the computer. It's not about putting those 80,000 words down. It's watching the film or reading the other book or having the conversation or walking down that road. It's all that gathering of stuff. And when I didn't have much time to write, I did have time for that. And there was like a trick in keeping your brain or a bit of your brain, sort of percentage of it dedicated to that story at all times. So in particularly dull work meetings that maybe I didn't have a very important role in, you'd suddenly find yourself being like, oh, I tell you what, that's quite good, and scribbling something down and like allowing that to keep churning all the time. So it wasn't like switched off and then I sit down and suddenly have to get back into it, but keeping it on the back burner, I suppose, at all times, and making sure I can find the rest, use all the things I'm doing in my life to feed into that rather than feel the guilt or the frustration of not being able to spend as much time as I might have liked.
With you obviously working full time, how long did it take you to write this book then, from like concept to published?
So The Drownings, I was working freelance, part-time slash freelance. So it was much swifter. Heatstroke, I need structure. So when I was writing Heatstroke, I did another course. I did the Curtis Brown course, which was brilliant, and got an enormous amount from it as a writer, but also got an enormous amount of it because of deadlines. And I'm really good with a deadline. I was like, right, well, I have to write this much. And that kept me on the straight and narrow, if you like. So The Drownings was swifter. The Heatstroke took probably 2 or 3 years to get to, and I'm not, again, I hear about these writers who can write a first draft in 6 weeks, and I'm like, oh, I am not one of those at all. I tinker as I go and edit as I go. For me, it's about, if the path has gone off by 1%, I'll continue, and that 1% will end up being 25. And so I need to constantly be going back over what I've done and make sure it's going the right way, because I just otherwise will end up like in that dream world. I'll end up somewhere very odd if I'm not careful. I have to keep it quite narrow. And The Drownings probably took about a year to 18 months to have the full draft. And of course, then it goes through many layers of edits and becomes, frankly, exponentially better than it was when I was on my own with it. And I worked with my agent and my editor on it to really make it stronger and slicker.
When you were doing that Curtis Brown course, were your tutors looking at heatstroke as you were working on it, or was that separate to the course?
Of course, my tutor actually was Erin Kelly, the writer who, and that was the main reason I wanted to do that course. I'd always loved her work. Poison Tree is one of my favorite books ever. And so the idea of being taught by her was, and she was everything I hoped she might be. And we had to submit 3,000 words. And I had an idea, but I didn't have 3,000. I'd written something previously that didn't really work, and I was looking for a new idea. And I was literally sitting at work, and it's the only time this has ever happened. And I wrote into an email, I've still got the body of the email, where I just scribbled out, like just sort of tapped through my fingers, and I don't normally think that way, this image of someone watching. This sounds odd to say, Anna. Someone watching a teenage girl in the back garden, and then you discover who it is who's watching. I just wrote about 2,996 words, and I sent it to my boyfriend and was like, is this any good? And he's like, yes, it is. This, do this. And that was what, I didn't even edit those words and sent that to Curtis Brown as my sort of submission. And actually, if you look at that email versus the first pages of Heatstroke, there's maybe 10% difference, if that. It was very much, this just came to me. And I'd love that to happen again, but it doesn't very often, I don't think. But this image of what I wanted to do, and it came sort of fairly fully formed, which was wonderful. And that's what I worked on during the Curtis Brown course. So I think I left that with more like 25,000 words, having written things alongside it, and a much, much clearer vision. The beauty of the Curtis Brown course, it's very good at helping you with that individual. My master's was amazing to be, what kind of writer do you want to be? What's the bigger universe of your craft? The Curtis Brown course was brilliant at the focus of, but in this book, in this story you're writing, what's the crux? What's it about? How can you make it stronger?
Oh, thank you. That'll be really helpful for our listeners. What is the best piece of advice that you've ever been given by another writer? And what advice would you give our listeners?
Again, I love structure. And I think both my master's and the Curtis Brown course really, as well as all the stuff you learn about your own writing, you learn how to take and give feedback. And it's really frightening. It's genuinely, and I think it's great practice to be a writer in the wider world, that sense of the exposure of it is not a side effect. It is the point of it in some ways. And it's very difficult to have someone look at something you have labored over and go, this could be loads better. And you're like, well, obviously it's the greatest thing anyone's ever done. And then you go, oh, yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I think getting good at taking feedback, and when you become edited, hopefully by an agent or an editor further on, having the ability to, I mean, everyone, I think you first read your editorial notes and think, this is ridiculous. How dare they? And then slowly over the space of a few hours, you're like, maybe. And by the end of the following day, you're like, yeah, this is obviously completely brilliant. And this is exactly what I need to do. You have to internalize it and metabolize it a bit. But you also, I think, learn when to go, advice isn't for me. And that's a good piece of advice, but it's not relevant to my story, and to almost put the barriers up a little bit and learn. So I loved getting an enormous amount of advice and feedback. But the single best piece was by a brilliant writer who was on my course at Oxford, who I remember, I still have this, with a green pen, slashed through the work and wrote on the top the words, be more subversive. And it was completely like game changing for me. I was like, I am being safe. He's like, in real life, you're more, frankly, more interesting than the work you're creating. There's more edge to you than what you're writing. And it really made me start, I was quite alarmed by it. It made me really stop and think and work out what that meant. And can I push things? Can I look at things from new angles? Can I twist the way I look? And it really changed the way I wrote Heatstroke, which is quite controversial. It covers quite difficult topics, and certainly the lead character is quite disliked by some readers, which was absolutely the point. And it helped me just go, no, I'm going to go to those places that feel quite uncomfortable, because that's sort of why I'm writing it. That's the exciting bit about it. So that was the best piece of advice that I ever took. And I think the question was also in the question, what advice would I give? And writing a book's really, it's 80,000 words, takes a really long time. And it takes an enormous amount of tenacity and resilience and time to do it, and discipline to do it. And for me, the way I've been able to do that is to create the world of the book, to create this space that I can tap back into when I need to. It's that thing of carrying the book with you at all times. Probably if you're sitting out writing, you probably don't have 3 or 4 months of beautiful, clean, fresh time to just write. You're probably doing it alongside family commitments and work, and goodness knows what else life throws. So for me, I like to create the universe of the book, from the Pinterest boards, which I'm obsessed with, to the smells. I have a different perfume for each one, and get back into songs really help me. So when I was writing Heatstroke, which was done in bits and drabs, I quote it at the beginning of the book, the song Cola by Lana Del Rey. My pitch to my agent the first time I met her was that Heatstroke was Lana Del Rey in Epsom, and I stand by that. That was the universe I wanted to create for that. And for The Drownings, it was The Feminine Urge by The Last Dinner Party, which is much sort of about anger and women rising up and the fragility and fury of that. And sometimes literally just listening to that music got me back into that state. But also, I think creating that universe of the book, creating something you're excited to get back into, that feels like a book you've read already, that feels like something you feels like the film they'll obviously make one day because it's going to be so brilliant, and making it feel like a space of joy, something you want to return to and immerse yourself in. That really helps me not only, I think, write in a hopefully more atmospheric or sensorial way, but also to convince myself to want to go back there and not feel it as a chore or a slog. And there are days I sit down to write and think, oh. And those days, I do what I think all writers do. I just read something. I read something that is what I aspire to write, or just that I really enjoy, that is just delicious. And I think so much of it for me is making sure that writing never feels like a drag or a chore, but just feels like this really wonderful, privileged, exciting thing to get to do.
And are you working on anything at the moment? Can you tell us about maybe a new book?
Yes, absolutely. I actually recently have half of a book into the cupboard to rest for a while. I was writing something that I was really excited about and that I still really hope to go back to one day, but it just wasn't quite clicking. There's something I haven't fathomed with it, and I'm not quite sure what it is. I was beginning to feel a bit less excited to go back to it, to be honest, a little bit like something in, and I think if I'm not excited, no reader's going to be. And I was beginning to think, I don't quite know if I love this enough. And I really hope that one day I work out what that thing is and can return to it and get my 40,000 words that I slaved over back and do something with them. But it was a Pinterest board, actually, that I love Pinterest. I find it a really great way. Sometimes, again, if I'm feeling a bit like the ideas aren't flowing, I'll just go in there and start playing with things and sticking things and seeing what I can do. Years ago, I'd just done this with a bit of an idea and I'd completely forgotten I'd done it. And I was looking through my boards and there was one that had a strange title that didn't mean anything to me. I clicked on it and a whole world was there. And the idea just landed, just the idea of what the plot would be. And again, I called my long-suffering boyfriend and was like, does this work? Is this good? He's like, yeah, keep going, write this, try and write this as a synopsis, which I then did. And it was almost like I sent it to myself from the past, when I most needed it. I don't really believe in stuff like that, but it's fun. And it was a lovely, like, that sense of, like, I just looked at it and thought, oh God, this is what I want to write, this is where I want to go. And it was so it's set in Camden Town in London in the early 2000s, so it's proper indie sleaze, which is my heritage. And it's a story of ambition and jealousy set in that time with the bands and the nightlife of the time. And it just felt like, as soon as I started like doing the research, I was like, this is just something I'm so excited to spend time doing, and I love these characters. And it came to life in a way, the book that I had put in the cupboard, and it will live in the dark or die in the dark, we'll find out one day. But this new book feels sparkling in a way that I hadn't got the same energy. And I think you do have to trust yourself and trust your own personal excitement around these things.
Oh, brilliant. Hopefully we'll get to give that one a read in the not so distant future, which is exciting. And we always end by asking for a book recommendation. What have you got for us?
Started a book I'm really excited about. I remember going to the Emerald Street Literary Festival, God rest her soul. I used to love that. It was on for about 3 years and it was amazing, and they don't do it anymore. And I saw Laura Barnett speak about the book Greatest Hits, which I absolutely loved. It's the story of a older singer-songwriter, and it goes back through her songs and tells her life. And she writes about music so beautifully, and I love that book so much, and read all of her other books, and her new book, Births, Deaths and Marriages, literally landed in my Kindle about a week ago. And I've just started it, and I can't wait for the weekend because I just want to sit with a cup of tea and absolutely through it. Assuming it's cool enough. It's so hot at the moment, a cup of tea would be a disaster. But assuming it's cooled down by the weekend, curl up with that. It's the story of a group of college friends reuniting after 10, 20 years, and how their lives have changed. And she writes so beautifully in such a nuanced way about relationships and the Hangul's complexity, and her sentences are beautiful. So I'm very excited to properly dive into it.
I'm going to add that to my list.
Oh, brilliant. And thanks so much for taking the time, Hazel. It's been absolutely brilliant to speak to you. And The Drownings is out now, so if anybody wants to go and read it, we've also got a podcast episode for our book club that is already out. So if anybody has already read it and they want to join our chat about it, then that episode is out and you can already find that.
Thank you so much, Hazel.
Thanks for tuning into The Write Club. We hope you enjoyed this episode and feel inspired to keep writing. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at Writers Online, your go-to for writing tips, competitions, and exclusive updates. Plus, you'll never miss an episode of The Write Club. Until next time. Happy writing.